Up the state versus Muhammad.
Good morning, Judge Verellin, and good morning to the court. I, Oliver Davis, represent Mr. Muhammad. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, if I may.
Okay.
The first question in this case is whether the information, whether the charging document, using language of common understanding and following the normal everyday rules of punctuation and grammar, was adequate to put Mr. Muhammad on notice of every element of the crime of indecent liberties. And that statute, which is 9A44-100, pretty plainly states that the crime occurs when the defendant knowingly has sexual contact with a person who is helpless or otherwise incapable of giving consent. In this case, the allegation was that the contact occurred when the complainant was sleeping. And may I ask that these be distributed, Your Honor?
Sure.
Take a stab at using this display. The top of the page is the Indecent Liberties Statute, and this is the language that this court looked at in State v. Lowe and concluded on several bases that the statute certainly required that the defendant know that the other person is sleeping or helpless or otherwise incapacitated. The low court looked at the language and expressly the grammar and the punctuation in the Indecent Liberties Statute and said that it's clear that knowingly applies to the fact of the person being sleeping or helpless. And also the court looked at a statutory defense which exists to this crime, which says that the defendant can prove as an affirmative defense that he reasonably believed the person was not sleeping. And this court reasoned that that also showed, in terms of looking at the statutory scheme as a whole, that indecent liberties does indeed require the defendant to know that the person is sleeping.
Certainly State versus Lowe in your favor. What if we disagree with State versus Lowe's interpretation of the statute and are unable to find, reading this language, that the knowingly applies to knowing that the other person is incapable of consent?
Well, certainly if that's the court's conclusion, then my argument doesn't succeed. I would suggest that the low court's reasoning was detailed and thorough and correct, and that there's no reason for this court to come to a different conclusion, even if we're to independently be looking at the statute for the first time. This statute is, it's all one sentence. There's not a meaningful comma in the entire portion of the statute we're looking at. A person is guilty of indecent liberties when he knowingly has sexual contact with somebody who is sleeping. And in the larger statutory scheme, it's interesting to note, and the respondent has made a comparison to the crime of rape, that crime, which has a somewhat similar structure to indecent liberties, it includes the alternative of incapacity, that rape in the second degree offense doesn't include the language knowingly. Neither does child molestation or child rape or, I believe, even rape one. The Indecent Liberties Statute, however, does include the word knowingly. Now, it's difficult to imagine that that word was inserted into this statute alone solely because the legislature was concerned about people being prosecuted for accidentally causing sexual contact. The word plainly goes to the entirety of the sentence that the statutes and its subsections form and indicates that the person must know that the other person is incapable of consent.
But just take a look, if you will, at the entire statute, 9A44-101. And, I mean, its structure has, there's like A and B and C all the way through to F. So it's, a person is guilty of indecent liberties when he or she knowingly causes another person, et cetera, to have sexual contact, colon. And then A, by forcible compulsion. So somehow you would attribute knowingly to forcible compulsion in A, and you would attribute it to C, when the victim is a person with a developmental disability and has supervisory authority over the victim, was providing transportation, et cetera. You would say knowingly applies to all of those things, too.
I would say it does. It's perhaps less controversial in the situation with subsection A, forcible compulsion. But all of these alternatives, and they appear on the reverse of the handout, are, by their plain language, all situations in which a person takes advantage of the circumstances of the complainant. If one is a healthcare worker, one should not have sexual contact with the person who is under your control. If a person is sleeping, one should not have sexual contact with that person. Absent knowledge that the person is sleeping, one simply has sexual contact with another individual without any guilty knowledge or mens rea that the person is incapable of consent. The respondent hasn't made this argument, but certainly this statute is not a strict liability statute under the factors, I believe it's Staples, that the court uses to assess that. Statute plainly includes a mens rea, and I believe that the question whether that applies to the fact that the person is sleeping is clear from the plain language of the statute. This court believed so, and the Supreme Court endorsed that reasoning when it affirmed this Court of Appeals, except as to the remedy issue, which is unrelated.
How about the affirmative defense in 030?
The affirmative defense applies if the defendant can show that he reasonably believed the person was not helpless.
Isn't that inconsistent with your reading of knowingly?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. The respondent has made an argument that, well, gosh, if the state has already proved that the defendant knew that the person was sleeping, how could a defendant succeed with an affirmative defense that he reasonably believed they were not? But of course, factual issues are in conflict at a trial and would be for the jury to decide. And the argument appears to be, well, you can't have an affirmative defense like this that appears to negate a required element of the crime, knowledge. But, of course, we know from State v. Camara that, indeed, the legislature is entitled to craft offenses and statutory defenses to those crimes, and it's simply not correct to say that the fact that an affirmative defense appears to conflict with an element in the crime means that that affirmative defense is invalid. It certainly doesn't mean that that element is not in the offense itself. I hope that answers your question. The comparison that the respondent has made pertains to a case called Abbott, in which the court looked at a different statutory defense, which was that the defendant can prove, or rather the statutory defense says it is no defense to crimes based on the complainant's age, that the defendant did not know that the person was under a certain age. That statutory offense is not the one at issue here, and it plainly states that knowledge is not an element of crimes where the offense is based on age. It doesn't have anything to do with this statutory defense and what the low court determined it shows about the elements of the crime.
You said that you thought the Supreme Court's decision in Lowe affirmed the Court of Appeals decision with respect to the elements and whether knowingly applies to B, but it doesn't really say that, does it?
No, but the Supreme Court approved of this court's 404B analysis, which was purposefully detailed and very closely looked at the question of the elements of the crime.
Indeed,
in order.
But this court said that the relevance was a couple of things. If the prior acts did come in, it was relevant to a couple of things, one of which was that supposed element of indecent liberties, but that wasn't the only thing to which it was relevant, and the Supreme Court did not address specifically that issue.
That is true. If I could move on to the question, and the court maybe believes that it's the less important question, but the language of the charging document, which is in the middle of the page, I'll just say very briefly, because of the commas setting off helplessness, does not make clear to an average reader that it is an element of the crime that one must know that the person is helpless or sleeping. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, Erin Becker on behalf of the state of Washington, the respondent in this matter. The state asks this court to affirm Mr. Muhammad's convictions, both because the information adequately set forth the elements of the crime and specifically that knowingly is not an element of the crime, and because there was sufficient evidence to find that Mr. Muhammad, for a rational jury to find that Mr. Muhammad had committed the crime of indecent liberties.
But what you really mean, knowingly is an element, but it doesn't extend to physical helplessness. I think that's what you mean.
That is exactly what I mean. Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to begin exactly where Mr. Davis began, which is talking about whether knowingly is an element that applies to the portion of the statute regarding the defendant's, whether the defendant needs to know that the victim is physically helpless. And the standard of review is de novo because it is a statutory interpretation. I think there's three critical things that this court should look at in making its decision. The first is grammar and punctuation and the fact that the word knowingly is an adverb. I gave this court a citation to the Chicago Manual of Style. Frankly, I think most grammar books would agree that when you use an adverb, it modifies the word that it is closest to, and the correct way to use an adverb is to place it next to the word it modifies so that we don't have any ambiguity. Applying that straightforward rule that the legislature is presumed to know, knowingly applies the word applies to the word causes and not to the many hundreds of words that flow thereafter. Judge Becker, I think you asked an excellent question about then does knowingly apply to everything following the colon under Mr. Davis's argument it would, and I think he conceded as such. So does the state have to prove that the defendant knows that the perpetrator is not married to the victim? That seems a useless thing to have the state prove, but that is one of the things that it comes after, although not immediately after the word knowingly, and then it repeats itself after the colon. I drew an analogy to the rape in the second degree statute because although there is no mens rea in that, it follows the same structure. And while it makes sense that there would be no mens rea as to the act in rape, but that there would be a mens rea as to the act in indecent liberties, it makes no sense for the legislature to make a distinction with respect to knowledge as to the victim's helpless status between those two crimes. Because someone can have sexual contact without intending it to be sexual contact or without knowingly causing such contact. It's very difficult to conceive of circumstances under which someone unintentionally or unknowingly has sexual intercourse with another person.
Much of the argument of your opponent is based on this court's decision in Lowe. Perhaps you better address that.
I will address that. I think the Lowe court does say, it's clear that the Lowe court and the Court of Appeals does say that the act should be construed the way that Mr. Davis is urging this court to construe it. My argument is first that that's dicta. It's clear that it's dicta because the issue before the Lowe court was a 404B question, not a statutory construction question. Unfortunately, I didn't have access to the briefing, so I'm not sure if the parties even argued it, but the analysis in Lowe is so brief and so cursory, it is mostly consigned to a footnote. Also, the Supreme Court then had the seminal case on 404B come in its decision affirming Lowe and made no mention whatsoever of the statutory construction, indicating that the statutory construction of the indecent liberties statute was irrelevant to the decision, which is the very meaning of dicta.
Well, and the fact is, I mean, a lot of times when the Court of Appeals makes a decision and the Supreme Court then takes review and comes out with its own comprehensive opinion, the Court of Appeals decision just kind of goes away. I mean, it's just pushed to the side. Nobody ever mentions it again.
Correct.
But, however, it is true, is it not, that when the Court of Appeals discusses certain things and makes holdings, and then the Supreme Court takes review and doesn't cover everything that was discussed in the Court of Appeals opinion, those holdings can remain vital.
Correct. We see it most often when the Supreme Court takes review on a different issue, and a number of the issues in the Court of Appeals opinion are untouched. This issue, though, was said by is claimed by Mr. Davis to be fundamental to the decision with respect to the admissibility of the 404B evidence, whether it was...
I understand the Court of Appeals decision in Lau, the way I understand its structure is this. First of all, there is a common scheme or plan exception under 404B, but that's not the end of the story because admissibility also depends on relevance. What is the relevance of the past events of having drugged women in order to rape them, the court asked itself, and came out with a couple of examples, one of which was, well, it's relevant because knowledge that the person was helpless is an element of the crime, and so this goes to that. It went to some other things as well. But having and then the Supreme Court discussed relevance in a more circumscribed fashion and just said, well, of course, it goes to the facts of the case. It helps. Without getting into necessarily the elements of the crime, but it just intuitively, I think, seems that when you have 404B evidence that comes in of past drugging events, it helps to make it more likely that this one happened.
I think Your Honor is exactly correct. That is why the low court at the Court of Appeals level was looking at the statutory language was for relevance and not for 404B. But the Supreme Court agreed that it was relevant without looking at the statutory structure. I would add two other points. One is that the WPICs have been substantially revised in the 20 years, but no one has revised, there's been no substantive revision to this, to the WPIC relating to indecent liberties in light of the Court of Appeals opinion in Lowe, suggesting that others think it is dicta as well. But the other thing I want to look at is that Lowe, even if this court thinks it's not dicta, it's probably appropriate to overrule it, given the analysis there, given the grammatical structure of indecent liberties, and given the inconsistency that Judge Borellin recognized between the affirmative defense and the claim that knowingly applies to the defendant's, that the defendant would need to know that the victim was physically helpless.
Do you know of any authority that says that with respect to the affirmative defense provision, that where there is an affirmative defense, it's inconsistent to also have it be part of the state's burden? I mean, in other words, is it any authority that it's an either-or proposition for the legislature? You either make it an element or you put it in the defense category.
I don't have the names of cases off the top of my head, but I'd point the court to a couple of directions. One is, well, I think Abbott, which I did cite, is very similar, although it's looking at the next section. I would also point to, and I don't have this at my fingertips, but I would direct the court to looking at the unwitting possession defense for possession of a controlled substance. And this court has affirmed that there is no mens rea requirement for possession of a controlled substance. And I suspect that part of that decision comes not just from the plain language, but from the unwitting possession defense. That's my guess. I'm not sure if that answers your question. But then third, I would just say from a logical perspective, it makes no sense and is fundamentally inconsistent to say the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant knew. But the defense can then prove by a preponderance of the evidence that although he had actual knowledge, he also reasonably believed the opposite to be true. That just fundamentally makes no sense. And if the court were to adopt a construction of the statute that applied knowingly to the physically helpless prong, to knowledge that the victim was physically helpless, it eviscerates and removes the effectiveness of that affirmative defense, and of course, one of the fundamental tenets of statutory construction.
It would be awfully confusing for the jury, would it not, to hear both of those things?
It's confusing to us, so I imagine that it is confusing to a jury, yes.
And the legislature would be unlikely to promote confusion in that way.
It would, and again, a fundamental tenet of statutory construction is to give meaning to what the legislature wrote and to apply knowingly to all of prong B relating to the victim's vulnerability would essentially write the affirmative defense, for all practical purposes, write that affirmative defense out of this statute. I'm not going to have time to talk about the sufficiency of the evidence, but I would urge the court to read carefully the victim's testimony, which is the critical part, where she's clear that she wakes up to having her vagina touched by the defendant. It's reasonable to infer that that occurred as she was asleep, and I would encourage this court and ask this court to affirm these convictions, or this conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
If it didn't matter whether the defendant knew or didn't know that the person was sleeping, then who cares whether he reasonably believed that they were awake? The defense is perfectly consistent with the crime. It statutorily says it applies to crimes that include this helplessness or a sleeplessness element. And there isn't any argument that can be made after Kamara that it's incompatible to have a crime that requires knowledge and an affirmative defense that the defendant must prove that he reasonably believed the person was sleeping. That's not the way. That negates analysis, no longer exists as an argument for the defense, and it cannot be employed by the respondent here.
Counsel, would you clarify something for me? When you look at the information, it has, at least the way I read it, elements, or it has the provisions of the lead paragraph, knowingly causing, having sexual contact, and it also has the provisions of B. Your argument seems to me that comma placement somehow makes it defective. Is that a fair statement?
With regard to the information?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Because the information reads that the defendant did knowingly cause complainant, comma, who wasn't the spouse and was physically helpless, comma, to have sexual contact with the defendant. The commas, and I would note that the respondent concedes that this information is defective.
I understand. I just want to get your reasoning.
I would look at those two commas as the Chicago Manual of Style does in Rule 6.24 and describe those as commas that are essentially parentheticals providing descriptive but non-essential information with regard to the clause preceding.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that concludes our calendar.